Imagine you are a psychiatrist, right? You've got this patient sitting across from you, and their brain is just so paralyzed by severe, relentless depression that no medication has worked for years.
Yeah, totally devoid of hope.
Exactly. The traditional SSRIs have failed. Therapy has, completely hit a wall. So, in a last-ditch effort, you hook this patient up to an IV. And you administer a tiny sub-anesthetic dose of a notorious 1990s club drug.
Which is a wild concept on its own.
It really is. So you sit back and you wait, and then 2 hours later, the depression is just gone. The heavy, suffocating blanket of despair has completely
You've
lifted.
vanished.
Yeah. The suicidal thoughts that were literally plaguing them when they walked into the clinic, they just completely vanished before lunchtime. For 50 years, the entire medical establishment thought a timeline like that was biologically impossible.
Right, they thought you needed weeks, if not months.
Exactly. So you, as a curious learner, have probably caught glimpses of this story in passing headlines. You've heard this molecule discussed in the most, wildly contradictory contexts imaginable.
Oh, absolutely. It's got such a fractured identity.
Right. Maybe you've seen it framed on the evening news as this dangerous underground party drug. Or perhaps you've seen it heralded in medical journals as this obscure, almost mystical new treatment for the mind that's just, rewriting the rules of psychiatry.
Yeah, it's a molecule that has carried a deeply fractured identity in the public consciousness for decades. I mean, we are looking at a substance that has simultaneously been the subject of DEA crackdowns and like breakthrough therapy designations from the FDA.
It's crazy. And that profound contradiction brings us to the central mystery of our deep dive today. How on earth did a battlefield anesthetic synthesized back in 1962, a chemical that became infamous for sending ravers into a terrifying, paralyzed state known as a K-hole, how did that exact same molecule become the most important psychiatric breakthrough in a half century?
A huge question.
It is. Today, we are pulling our insights from an incredibly detailed, just published article from the OOTW Journal. Today is July 28, 2026, and the piece we are exploring is titled Ketamine and the NMDA Receptor: The Neuroscience of Rapid Antidepressant Action.
It's a fantastic paper. Really gets into the weeds.
It does. Our mission for this deep dive is very clear. We are going to strip away the cultural stigma. We're going to mute the pop culture hype, and we're going to drill all the way down to the exact biological and structural mechanisms happening inside the brain.
Yeah, getting to the actual physical reality.
Exactly. We want to understand how this specific molecule can pull a human mind out of the darkest depths of treatment-resistant depression in a matter of hours, not weeks. Hours. Okay, let's unpack this.
What's fascinating here is that this single molecule didn't merely give doctors, a shiny new pharmaceutical tool to add to their existing medical toolkit.
Right.
It accomplished something much rarer. It entirely rewrote the textbook on what depression actually is, neurologically speaking.
Wow, rewrote the textbook.
Literally, it forced the field to shift the paradigm away from viewing depression as just a simple chemical imbalance and instead revealed it to be a physical structural problem of the brain's wiring.
Okay, to really grasp the magnitude of this textbook rewriting moment, we have to look backward before we look forward. We have to understand the decades of entrenched assumptions that this drug ultimately shattered.
Yeah, you have to look at the history.
Right. Let's start with the bizarre double life of ketamine before it ever entered a modern psychiatric clinic. Because before you can understand the miracle of the mechanism, you really have to understand the stigma and where it came from.
Well, you have to trace it all the way back to a laboratory in 1962. Ketamine was first synthesized by an American chemist named Calvin Stevens.
Okay, 1962.
Yeah, and the intent behind its creation was actually to solve a very serious medical problem. It was designed specifically to be a safer, shorter-acting successor to another anesthetic, phencyclidine.
Phencyclidine, wait, is that PCP?
Exactly, which most people know today as PCP.
PCP. Wait, the drug that causes those infamous stories of people exhibiting superhuman strength and extreme paranoia, that was used as a medical anesthetic.
It was, for a brief period in the 1950s, yeah. PCP was actually highly effective at blocking pain, but the emergence from anesthesia was an absolute nightmare for doctors and patients alike.
Like waking up from it was bad.
Oh, horrible. Patients waking up from PCP anesthesia would often experience severe, unpredictable psychiatric side effects. We're talking profound delirium, hallucinations, agitation, extreme confusion.
That sounds terrifying in a hospital
It
setting.
was far too volatile for standard medical use. So researchers went looking for a chemical analog, a molecule with a similar structure that could provide the pain release and sedation of PCP, but without the terrifying, long-lasting psychotic emergence.
Got it. And that search led to ketamine.
Exactly.
So it was essentially engineered to be PCP's better behaved sibling.
That's a good way to put it.
And it quickly proved its worth in the medical field, didn't it? The source material mentions it had this incredibly unique profile that made it invaluable, particularly in the operating room and on the battlefield during the Vietnam War.
Yeah, for anesthesiologists, ketamine was a total revelation. It remains a uniquely safe tool to this day, actually.
Really? Still today?
Oh, yeah. To understand why, you have to look at the dangers of traditional anesthetics.
Huh.
When you put a patient under with most general anesthetics, you're walking a tightrope.
Right, because you're shutting down the body.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You run the very real risk of suppressing the patient's respiratory drive or causing their blood pressure to plummet to dangerous levels.
Which is bad.
Very bad. The drugs that knock you out also tend to knock out the primitive brainstem functions that keep you breathing. You need ventilators, constant monitoring, a full suite of life support equipment.
So it's a huge production.
But ketamine behaves entirely differently. It is categorized as a dissociative anesthetic.
Dissociative. So it's separating things. I assume it separates the conscious mind from the physical sensation of pain, but the body just keeps running on its basic autopilot.
That captures the dynamic perfectly, yeah.
Yeah.
At anesthetic doses, ketamine provides profound total pain relief, and it completely disconnects the patient's consciousness from their environment.
They're just gone.
They're deeply dissociated. But critically, it does not shut down the respiratory system. It does not suppress the heart rate or blood pressure. In fact, it often slightly elevates them.
I can see why that would be a miracle on a battlefield. If you have a soldier with a severe trauma injury in a jungle environment, you don't have an anesthesiology cart and a mechanical ventilator handy.
Exactly. You don't have a whole ICU.
Right. You need something that will stop their pain and keep them entirely unaware of the surgery while their body breathes entirely on its own.
And that unique safety profile made it a staple in emergency medicine, pediatric procedures, burn units, trauma situations where resources are scarce. It was the reliable, life-saving workhorse of the medical world.
But then we have the flip side of the coin. The life-saving workhorse escapes the sterile hospital environment and finds its way into the underground rave culture.
Yeah, that's where the stigma really took hold. During the 1980s and especially the 1990s, ketamine became highly sought after as a recreational club drug.
Because of that dissociative effect.
Right, because it is a dissociative, taking it at various sub-anesthetic doses induces a state where the user's normal sense of reality begins to distort.
And at higher doses.
At higher recreational doses, the user's entire sense of self begins to dissolve completely.
And this is what the culture dubbed the K-hole.
Hmm.
I've heard that term thrown around in movies, but neurologically, what is actually happening in a K-hole?
A K-hole is a state of profound, nearly total dissociation. The user becomes entirely disconnected from their physical body and their sensory surroundings.
So they're just trapped in their mind.
Essentially, yeah. They are awake, but their brain is cut off from receiving any input from the outside world. It can be a terrifying experience of sensory deprivation and paralysis, or it can be a deeply profound, altered state of perception, depending on the user's mindset.
Wow.
But regardless of the subjective experience, it cemented the drug's reputation as a powerful, illicit hallucinogen.
So for half a century, you have this molecule living a Jekyll and Hyde existence. On Monday, it's the anesthesiologist's reliable standby for emergency pediatric surgery. On Saturday night, it's fueling intense dissociative trips in a warehouse rave.
It's quite the contrast.
It really is. And looking at those two reputations, neither of them suggests anything remotely related to treating clinical depression.
Oh, not at all. If you had walked into a psychiatric conference in the 1980s or 1990s and boldly declared that a notorious club drug known for inducing temporary paralysis and hallucinations was the future of depression treatment, you would have been laughed out of the room.
It just sounded crazy.
It ran counter to everything the medical establishment believed about the brain.
But then, right around the turn of the millennium, this medical rebellion starts brewing. The OOTW journal article highlights a massive shift in how researchers viewed this molecule. Can you walk us through that turning point?
Yeah, so the very first faint signal in the noise came from a small study published in the year 2000. Researchers testing ketamine for other purposes noticed an unexpected rapid antidepressant effect in their subjects.
Just a total accident.
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. But because it was a very small sample size and because ketamine carried so much cultural baggage, the medical world at large didn't immediately change course.
Right, they probably wrote it off as a fluke.
Exactly. The real earthquake, the landmark moment that forced the entire field of psychiatry to stop and pay attention, was a 2006 trial led by a researcher named Carlos Zarat at the National Institute of Mental Health.
The NIMH. So this wasn't some fringe clinic. This was the top tier of American medical research.
Yes, the absolute top tier.
What exactly did Zarat and his team do in this 2006 trial that was so rebellious?
Well, they took a group of patients who were suffering from severe medication-resistant depression.
Okay, let's define that.
Yeah, we need to be clear about what medication-resistant means here.
Yeah.
These were not people experiencing mild temporary sadness.
Right.
These were individuals for whom multiple traditional daily antidepressants had completely failed. They were profoundly sick, many were severely impaired in their daily functioning, and they had been suffering for years.
Just out of options.
Completely. And the psychiatrist did something that sounded almost reckless to their peers at the time. They hooked these patients up to an intravenous line, and they administered a single tiny sub-anesthetic dose of ketamine.
When you say sub-anesthetic, we're talking about a fraction of what you'd use to put someone under for trauma surgery, right?
A very small fraction. It was roughly 0.5 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, infused slowly over 40 minutes.
Not a quick shot.
No, a slow drip.
Yeah.
It was just enough to introduce the molecule into the brain circuitry, but not nearly enough to induce general anesthesia or put them to sleep.
And then what?
And then the researchers simply sat back and watched the clinical monitors.
And what they saw, I mean, reading the timeline in the source material, it is just staggering. Patients began reporting a noticeable lifting of their depression within 2 hours.
Yeah, 2 hours.
Let me just pause here to emphasize how utterly insane this must have sounded to the medical establishment at that moment.
Yeah.
For decades, the entire field operated on the assumption that depression was a serotonin problem.
The famous monoamine hypothesis.
Right. You give a patient an SSRI pill and you tell them to come back in 4 to 6 weeks to see if the chemical balance in their brain has slowly shifted.
Right. It was all about the waiting game.
And suddenly someone takes a club drug, puts it in an IV, and fixes the depression before the patient even has time to eat lunch.
It was nothing short of heretical to the established dogma. The entire psychiatric field operated on that idea that fixing depression required a slow, gradual accumulation of neurotransmitters like serotonin or norepinephrine.
It was treated like a biological law.
Yes. And here, patients were reporting a dramatic, undeniable lifting of the heaviest, most suffocating depressive symptoms in a matter of hours.
That's just wild.
Furthermore, the clinical benefits of that single 40-minute infusion didn't just fade away when the drug left their system. The antidepressant effect lasted for about a week.
A whole week from one small dose. And the source also points out that it didn't just lift the general mood or give them a temporary high. There was a very specific, dangerous symptom it targeted that really set it apart from everything else on the market.
Yeah, that is arguably the most crucial clinical finding of the Zarat trial and subsequent research. Ketamine rapidly reduced suicidal thinking.
Wow.
Prior to this discovery, there was genuinely no psychiatric drug in existence that could acutely, rapidly shut down active suicidal ideation.
So if someone came into the ER in crisis?
If a patient presented in an emergency room in acute crisis, the only real pharmacological option doctors had was heavy sedation, essentially putting them to sleep to keep them safe, or starting them on an SSRI and just hoping they survived the weeks it took for the medication to kick in.
That is incredibly bleak.
It was. Ketamine intervened directly and immediately on the suicidal ideation itself, stripping away the crisis in real time.
That is an unbelievable paradigm shift, and you can see why this observation forced a total reevaluation of the science. If a drug can work that fast, if it can flip a switch and turn off suicidal depression in 2 hours, it implies that our entire map of what causes depression in the first place must have been fundamentally flawed.
Exactly.
We were staring at the wrong map for 50 years.
The logic was inescapable. If severe depression can vanish in 2 hours, it simply cannot merely be a slow-moving serotonin deficiency.
It doesn't make sense.
No, the biological root cause of the suffering had to be something entirely different, operating on a much faster timeline. This realization pointed the researchers away from the slow chemical soup of serotonin and directed them toward a completely different neurotransmitter system.
Right. So if we now know serotonin isn't the immediate culprit, researchers had to look for a different molecular target that operates on that rapid-fire timeline.
Correct.
And that meant looking past the broad chemical environment of the brain down into the actual electrical wiring, specifically focusing on a new suspect, glutamate. To explain why ketamine works so incredibly fast, we have to zoom way, way in on the microcircuitry.
We really do. We have to leave serotonin behind entirely for this part of the conversation and introduce glutamate.
Okay, let's meet glutamate.
Glutamate is the brain's primary excitatory neurotransmitter. If you conceptualize the human brain as a vast, incredibly complex electrical network of signals, glutamate is the master go signal.
The go signal.
Yes, it is the driving force behind the vast majority of what your cortex does every single second. It is absolutely essential for activating neurons, facilitating learning, encoding memory, and driving general cognitive function.
So, if I'm trying to picture this, glutamate is essentially the gas pedal of the brain. It's the fuel that makes the neurons fire and communicate.
That's a very accurate way to visualize it.
Yeah.
Now, for glutamate to actually do its job and hit that gas pedal, it has to physically bind to specific receptors on the receiving neurons across the synapse.
Like a key in a lock.
Exactly. And the most important receptor for our story today, the one that ketamine interacts with, is called the NMDA receptor.
The NMDA receptor. The OOTW Journal article refers to this specific receptor as a molecular coincidence detector.
Yeah, that's a great term.
I love that phrasing. It sounds like something out of a spy novel. But what does it actually mean for a microscopic brain receptor to be a coincidence detector?
It means that the NMDA receptor is a highly guarded lock. It doesn't just indiscriminately open its channel anytime a stray molecule of glutamate floats by.
Oh, so it's picky.
Very picky. For the NMDA receptor to open up and allow calcium ions to flow into the receiving cell, which is the fundamental action that passes the electrical signal forward, two very specific conditions must be met simultaneously.
Okay, what are they?
First, the receiving cell has to already be slightly electrically activated or depolarized. Second, glutamate must be present in the synapse.
I see.
The receptor literally detects the coincidence of these two events happening at the exact same millisecond.
Why is it so strictly guarded? Why not just open whenever the gas pedal is pressed?
Because the influx of calcium through the NMDA receptor is a highly powerful event. It triggers long-lasting changes in the neuron.
Oh, so you don't want it happening randomly.
Exactly. This strict coincidence requirement is at the very heart of neuroplasticity. It is the physical mechanism by which our brain strengthens important synapses and ignores irrelevant noise. It is the biological basis of how we learn and form memories.
Okay, so let me make sure I have the pieces on the board. We have glutamate, which is the brain's main gas pedal, the excitatory signal.
Right. And we have the NMDA receptor, which is this highly guarded selective lock that receives that gas to trigger learning and activation. Where does the ketamine molecule fit into this microscopic picture?
Ketamine acts as an NMDA receptor antagonist.
Antagonist, meaning it blocks or fights against the receptor.
Precisely. When the ketamine molecule enters the brain's circuitry, it has a specific affinity for this receptor. It slips right inside the open ion channel of the NMDA receptor and acts like a physical plug.
Just clogs it up.
It wedges itself in there and physically blocks the channel so ions can no longer pass through, even if glutamate is present. Interestingly, it plugs the channel at the exact same binding site that PCP does, which explains their shared history.
Okay, let me stop you right there because this is where my brain hits a massive logical contradiction. I am following the mechanical steps you're laying out, but the final outcome makes absolutely no sense to
I
me.
know exactly where you're going with this.
Right. You just established that glutamate is the brain's main go signal. It's the engine of excitation and thought.
Ketamine comes in and physically plugs up the receptor that receives this go signal. So, logically speaking, shouldn't that suppress the brain's activity? Shouldn't that slow the entire network down?
That is the logical assumption, yes.
And if it slows the brain down, how on earth does that cure depression? Depression is a condition that already feels like you're stuck in the mud, like your thoughts are running through thick molasses and you have no energy. Why would suppressing the go signal pull you out of the mud? It feels totally backward.
It really does. That logical contradiction is the exact puzzle that stumped neuroscientists for years. It seems totally paradoxical on its face.
Because it is.
And to be fair to your logic, at high doses, the surgical anesthetic doses we talked about earlier, ketamine does slow everything down. A massive dose of ketamine floods the brain and indiscriminately blocks NMDA receptors broadly across the entire cortex, leading to a shutdown of sensory processing and that profound sedation.
Because it's literally blocking all the gas pedals everywhere at once. The engine stalls.
Right. But here is the elegant, beautiful surprise of neuropharmacology. The key to the paradox lies in the low sub-anesthetic dose used in psychiatric clinics.
Okay, the tiny dose.
At that tiny dose, ketamine doesn't just blanket the brain and block every NMDA receptor it happens to bump into. It exhibits a highly selective preference.
Preference for what?
It preferentially targets NMDA receptors that are sitting on a very specific, rare type of cell. Inhibitory GABA interneurons.
Inhibitory GABA interneurons. GABA. I always associate GABA with relaxation. It's in sleep supplements and anti-anxiety medications.
Exactly. It's the calming chemical.
So how does targeting a relaxation circuit cause a massive surge in brain activity?
Well, let's look at what those GABA interneurons actually do.
Yeah.
Their entire biological job is to quiet other neurons. They are the regulatory brakes of the brain's circuitry.
Brakes. Okay.
They release inhibitory signals to keep the neighboring excitatory neurons in check, preventing the network from firing too rapidly or burning out. They enforce the speed limit.
Okay, I see the dominoes falling now. This is such a brilliant biological loophole. Let me see if I can translate this into a visual for the listener.
Go for it.
It's like driving a car. When you give a severely depressed person a low dose of ketamine, you aren't pressing the gas pedal to speed their sluggish brain up. You are actively cutting the brake lines.
That is a perfect analogy. By selectively blocking the NMDA receptors on those specific GABA interneurons, ketamine prevents them from receiving their activating signal. It effectively silences the silencers.
You silence the silencers, so the brakes are completely offline.
Yes. And once those regulatory brakes are suddenly removed from the system, the neighboring excitatory neurons, the millions of neurons that use glutamate, are rapidly disinhibited.
Freed up.
They are freed up from their constraints. As a result, they begin firing much more freely, releasing a massive, sharp surge of glutamate into the surrounding synaptic network.
So by blocking a glutamate receptor in just the right, highly specific microscopic location, you end up creating a massive flood of glutamate everywhere else.
The NMDA blocker, paradoxically, causes a glutamate burst.
Mm-hmm.
That initial disinhibited surge of glutamate is the spark that lights the fire of clinical recovery.
Man, that is elegant. But knowing that we have a flood of glutamate doesn't fully answer the ultimate question. We've established that ketamine creates this surge by cutting the GABA brake lines.
Right.
But how does a temporary chemical surge cure the crushing weight of clinical depression in just 2 hours? What is that glutamate actually doing physically to the brain tissue?
To understand the actual healing, we have to follow that surge of glutamate. This massive pulse floods into the synapses.
Okay, the flood is unleashed.
But remember the current state of the board. The NMDA receptors are currently blocked by the ketamine plug, so this huge surplus of glutamate have to find somewhere else to go.
Oh, right. The normal doors are locked.
Exactly. So it ends up hammering a completely different type of glutamate receptor on the cell surface called the AMPA receptor.
AMPA. Okay. We have NMDA, which is blocked, and AMPA, which is now receiving the full force of the flood.
And this AMPA activation is the pivot point of the entire antidepressant effect. When all this surplus glutamate binds to the AMPA receptors, it triggers a profound biological domino effect deep inside the receiving neuron.
What's the first domino?
The first major domino to fall in this cascade is the release of a crucial protein called BDNF.
The OOTW Journal article goes into detail on BDNF. It stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor. The text describes it as the brain's master growth signal.
It is the ultimate fertilizer for the brain.
Fertilizer, I like that.
BDNF is a protein that is absolutely essential for the survival of existing neurons and for encouraging the growth and differentiation of new synaptic connections.
Okay.
When the AMPA cascade forces the release of BDNF, that protein reaches inside the cell and flips the molecular switch, turning on a specific metabolic pathway known as the MTOR pathway.
MTOR. MTOR. The source material spends a lot of time on this pathway. It seems to be the engine of the actual physical change.
It really is. If BDNF is the project manager or the architect calling for new infrastructure to be built, the MTOR pathway is the machinery that actually does the work.
The construction crew.
Yes. Once activated by BDNF, this MTOR pathway immediately gets to work. Within a matter of hours, which lines up perfectly with the clinical timeline patient's experience, MTOR literally drives the physical construction of new dendritic spines.
Dendritic spines, let's make sure we have a clear picture of what those are. These are the physical connection points between neurons, correct? The actual bridges where one cell talks to another.
Yes. Think of a neuron like a tree. The long branches extending outward are the dendrites, and the spines are the tiny microscopic twigs growing off those branches.
Got it.
The tips of those twigs are where the leaves, the actual synapses, connect with neighboring trees. When MTR is activated by the ketamine cascade, it acts like a cellular 3D printer.
A 3D printer for the brain.
Exactly. It takes raw protein materials floating inside the neuron and instantly begins printing new physical twigs onto the branches of the neurons.
It's literally printing new hardware.
It is rapidly growing new synaptic connections, specifically in areas of the brain that are critical for complex thought, emotional regulation, and executive function, like the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus.
Wait, so if I'm understanding you correctly, we aren't just chemically numbing the brain to make the sadness go away.
Not at all.
We are actually watching the brain rebuild its own physical hardware in real time. Why is growing new microscopic twigs on brain cells the cure for depression? I always thought depression was just a lack of happy chemicals.
This is where ketamine forces us to fundamentally redefine what we believe depression is at a structural, physical level. For years, neuroscientists using advanced imaging have observed one of the most robust and tragic findings in mental health research. Severe chronic stress literally prunes synapses.
Prunes them, like a gardener aggressively cutting away branches, but in a destructive way.
Yes. Under relentless chronic stress, the kind of inescapable trauma or stress that leads to severe clinical depression, the brain is constantly bathed in high levels of stress hormones, particularly cortisol.
Cortisol, the stress hormone.
Right. Over an extended period, this toxic cortisol-soaked environment causes the dendrites to shrink and retract. The spines wither away. The physical connections thin out.
The tree loses its branches.
Exactly. The prefrontal cortex, which is the part of your brain that handles logical planning, optimism, and emotional regulation, literally loses its connectivity. The physical wiring degrades.
So the signals just can't get through.
Right. The signals can't get through. So depression is not just a transient state of feeling sad or having low serotonin. It is, in a very real, measurable physical sense, a structural disorder of lost connectivity. The physical network has broken down.
Here's where it gets really interesting for the listener. When you conceptualize depression as a physical loss of wiring rather than just a bad mood, the difference between the old treatments and ketamine becomes night and day.
It's a completely different approach.
Yeah. Think about how traditional SSRIs, the daily serotonin pills, operate. They try to slowly coax a chemical rebalancing. You elevate ambient serotonin levels, and you just cross your fingers and hope that over weeks or months, the chemical environment improves enough that the brain eventually decides to heal itself and maybe slowly regrow some of those lost connections.
Yeah, it's an indirect, agonizingly slow process of hoping the soil gets better.
That's an excellent way to frame it. SSRIs are working indirectly, trying to create conditions favorable for eventual healing. But ketamine short circuits that entire agonizing timeline.
Because it's not waiting around for the environmental soil to change.
Right. It triggers a rapid, immediate structural rebuild of the exact synapses that the chronic stress destroyed. By cutting the brakes, flooding the AMPA receptors, and turning on that MTOR 3D printer, you aren't waiting on a chemical. You are watching the literal wiring of the brain come back online in hours.
It is a profoundly hopeful biological discovery. When you look at the brain imaging of a mouse model before and after ketamine, you are literally seeing the physical architecture of thought and emotion being rapidly repaired. The void spaces fill back in with new connections.
The mechanics of that are stunning. The idea that a single molecule can initiate a physical rebuild of the brain's hardware is incredible. But looking at the source material, this leads us into a much more complicated and honestly highly controversial territory.
Yeah, the subjective effects.
Right, because while all this beautiful microscopic 3D printing is happening silently in the prefrontal cortex, the actual human patient sitting in the clinical chair is experiencing something very intense and sometimes very strange.
It's not a subtle experience.
Let's shift our focus to what it actually feels like to undergo this treatment. We need to talk about the dissociation debate.
You really cannot have a complete conversation about ketamine without addressing the profound subjective experience of the patient. Even at the tiny sub-anesthetic doses used to treat depression, ketamine reliably produces its signature neurological effect, dissociation.
The OOTW Journal describes the clinical experience vividly. Patients report a floating detachment.
Very common, yeah.
They experience an altered sense of time, a disconnection from their physical body, and a blurring of their sense of self. Sometimes people report vivid out-of-body experiences or even mystical, ineffable feelings of unity. I understand the molecular cascade of growing new twigs, but what is happening mechanically to cause this intensely weird floating trip?
Biologically, the dissociative trip comes down to how ketamine disrupts thalamocortical signaling.
Thalamocortical signaling. I'm going to need you to unpack that terminology for us.
Sure. Let's look at the anatomy. Deep in the center of your brain is a structure called the thalamus. The thalamus acts as the brain's grand relay station or central switchboard.
Okay, the switchboard.
It takes in all the raw sensory information from your body and the outside world, what you see, hear, feel, and touch, and it routes those signals up to the cortex, which is the outer layer of the brain where you consciously process reality.
So it's feeding me the world.
Exactly. This constant, lightning-fast, seamless communication between the switchboard and the processing center, this thalamocortical signaling, is what binds all your sensory input into a single, cohesive model of you existing in the present moment.
So the thalamus sending signals to the cortex is the mechanism that makes me feel like I am sitting in this specific chair, looking at this specific room as a unified physical person. It's the anchor of reality.
Exactly. When ketamine enters the brain and begins blocking NMDA receptors, it acts as a chemical wedge, temporarily loosening or disrupting that critical communication pathway.
The signals get blocked.
The sensory data from the thalamus stops arriving at the cortex in its normal, tightly bound, synchronous package. Because the cortex is suddenly deprived of that steady stream of anchoring sensory data, your brain's seamless self-model begins to break down. You feel detached from your physical form because the signals confirming your physical presence are being intercepted. Your consciousness is essentially unmoored from the physical hardware.
It sounds intensely psychedelic. It sounds like the descriptions you hear of high-dose psilocybin or LSD, which brings up the great debate currently raging in the psychiatric community.
Oh, it's a huge debate.
Was this trip, this intense floating dissociation, just a weird, unavoidable side effect that happens to ride along with the molecular repair we just talked about? Or is the altered state functionally necessary for the healing to occur?
This is one of the most hotly contested, actively debated questions in the field of neuroscience and psychiatry today.
It perfectly mirrors the conversation around classic psychedelics, doesn't it? Where the set and setting, the environment, the music, the emotional experience of the trip itself are considered absolutely crucial to the therapeutic outcome.
Yes, very similar.
You can't just take the drug in a sterile white room and expect a miracle. The psychological journey is the therapy.
The parallels are striking. On one side of the ketamine debate, you have the strict neuropharmacologists and biological psychiatrists. To them, the dendritic spine growth, the AMPA to BDNF to MTOR cascade, is the only thing that matters.
They just care about the hardware.
Right. It is a purely mechanical process to them. In their view, the dissociation is just an unfortunate, messy, off-target side effect that complicates treatment and requires expensive clinical monitoring. If they could engineer a drug to get rid of the trip entirely and just keep the structural neuroplasticity, they would do it in a heartbeat.
They just want the cellular 3D printer. They don't want the spiritual journey. But what is the argument from the other side?
The other side, often psychologists and those studying the phenomenology of the drug, argues that the psychological experience of stepping entirely outside your rigid, depressed ego is therapeutic in its own right.
How so?
Well, severe depression is characterized by rigid, inescapable, deeply entrenched negative thought loops. You are trapped in a narrative of despair.
Yeah, that makes sense.
If you use a drug to completely dissolve a person's sense of self and disconnect them from their painful physical reality for 45 minutes, you give them a profound psychological break from their own suffering.
It provides a literal shift in perspective. You can't ruminate on how terrible your life is if you temporarily forget you have a physical body.
Exactly. They argue that you cannot easily separate the psychological revelation from the biological repair. The subjective experience of the trip loosens the rigid thought patterns, while the MTOR pathway physically rewires the brain to support that new, flexible mindset.
Hand in glove.
They work in tandem. Clinical trials are actively trying to tease this apart right now, using various blocking agents to see if nullifying the subjective experience mathematically reduces the biochemical antidepressant effect.
And just as the field is deeply entrenched in debating whether the trip is necessary, the OOTW Journal article throws a massive, unexpected twist into the narrative.
OHNK data.
Yes. A biological curveball from 2016 that complicates everything we just talked about. Let's delve into the HNK discovery. Because when I read this section of the source material, it completely blew my mind and upended the neat little mechanism we just built.
It is a brilliant confounding complication that shows how little we still truly understand. In 2016, a landmark study published in the journal Nature took a different approach.
What did they do?
Instead of looking at the ketamine molecule itself, the researchers looked at how the body breaks the drug down. When you ingest any medication, your liver enzymes immediately go to work, chopping the molecule up into different chemical byproducts, which are called metabolites.
Okay, metabolites.
One of the specific metabolites of ketamine is a molecule with a very long chemical designation, 2R6R, hydroxynorketamine. For sanity's sake, we'll just refer to it as HNK.
HNK, got it. The liver chops up ketamine and produces HNK.
Right. The researchers in the 2016 study decided to isolate this specific HNK metabolite and administer it directly to depressed mice without giving them the parent ketamine drug.
Yeah, just the byproduct.
And they found that the HNK metabolite lifted the depressive symptoms in the mice just as rapidly and effectively as the full ketamine dose did.
Okay, logically that tracks. The drug breaks down into a byproduct, and the byproduct carries on doing the exact same job of blocking the NMDA receptor and cutting the brakes.
But here's the massive twist that sent shockwaves through the field. The researchers discovered that HNK does not block the NMDA receptor at all.
Wait, what? We literally just spent the last 20 minutes talking about the beautiful, elegant paradox of cutting the NMDA brakes.
I know.
The coincidence detector, the GABA interneurons silencing the silencers. That was the entire fundamental mechanism of the miracle.
I know. Clinton's up in the entire narrative. The HNK metabolite bypasses the NMDA receptor entirely. It has no affinity for it. It doesn't plug the channel. Instead, this metabolite seems to act directly on the AMPA receptors.
Let me make sure I'm visualizing this correctly. Instead of knocking over the first domino-blocking NMDA to cause a glutamate surge, HNK just skips the first step entirely and pushes over the second domino, the AMPA receptor, directly.
That is the current hypothesis, yes. It directly stimulates the AMPA receptor, initiating the BDNF and mTOR cascade without ever interacting with the NMDA brakes.
That is wild.
And here is the most crucial clinical implication of that bypass. Because HNK does not block the NMDA receptor, HNK does not cause dissociation. It does not disrupt thalamocortical signaling. It does not cause the trip.
Hold on. Does this mean we could theoretically isolate the biological healing from the psychedelic trip?
That's the hope.
Is this the holy grail the pharmaceutical industry has been looking for? A synthesized drug that triggers the cellular 3D printer to regrow the brain's wiring, but without sending the patient into an out-of-body experience.
That is precisely why this 2016 discovery initiated a massive race within the pharmaceutical industry. It represents the absolute holy grail for next-generation antidepressants.
A tripless ketamine.
Exactly. If you can harness the HNK metabolite or engineer a novel compound that mimics it, you might get all the rapid synaptic regrowth, the AMPA to BDNF to mTOR structural repair, without the dissociation, without the heavy sedation, without the need for 2 hours of intense clinical supervision, and potentially without the abuse potential that makes ketamine a controlled substance. You could have a rapid-acting pill you take at home.
So given this HNK data, does this mean the whole NMDA story we spent the first half of the deep dive exploring is just wrong? Was Zoraide's premise flawed?
No, it's not that the NMDA story is wrong, but rather that it is likely not the exclusive pathway to healing. The brain is infinitely complex.
It's never just one thing, is it?
Rarely. Ketamine likely acts through multiple simultaneous pathways. The parent molecule blocks NMDA and cuts the brakes, causing a glutamate surge, while simultaneously the liver produces HNK, which directly stimulates AMPA.
A multi-pronged attack.
Exactly. It's a multi-pronged attack on depression. But the key unifying takeaway from the source material is this. Whether the cascade starts at the NMDA receptor, or whether it starts directly at the AMPA receptor via metabolite, all roads ultimately lead to the exact same destination.
That 3D printer.
Yes. AMPA activation, BDNF release, and MTO-driven structural synaptic regrowth. That physical rebuilding of the dendritic spines is the undeniable core mechanism of rapid healing.
Okay, let's pull our perspective out of the microscopic world of cellular cascades, lab mice, and metabolites. We need to bring this back to the macro level, to the present day, July 2026. What does all of this complex neuroscience actually mean for a real breathing patient seeking help for their depression right now? Let's transition to clinical reality, monotherapy approvals, and crucially, the honest risks involved. Because we need to be clear, this is not just a magic, consequence-free potion.
It absolutely is not. It is a highly potent, volatile medical tool that demands extreme respect and clinical caution. But to accurately understand the current clinical landscape for a patient today, we have to talk about a specific, patented version of ketamine that has successfully navigated the rigorous FDA approval process, esketamine.
The OOTW Journal mentions the chiral nature of the ketamine molecule in relation to esketamine. Let's quickly define what chirality is for the listener, because it's a neat piece of chemistry.
Chirality is a fascinating structural property found in many organic molecules. It means that a molecule exists in two distinct forms that are exact mirror images of each other. Think of your left and right hands.
Okay. They're the same but flipped.
Right. They have the exact same fingers, the same components, but they are arranged in opposite orientations in 3D space. You can't perfectly overlay your left hand onto your right hand. The ketamine molecule exists in an S form and an R form.
Left-handed ketamine and right-handed ketamine.
Exactly. Now, standard generic ketamine, the inexpensive drug that has been used in anesthesiology for decades and was used in the early Zorat trials, is a 50-50 mix of both the left and right hands.
Just a blend.
It's what chemists call racemic ketamine. However, pharmaceutical companies, through extensive testing, realized that the S form of the molecule esketamine binds significantly more tightly and potently to the NMDA receptor than the R form.
So the S form is a sharper, more potent wedge for the receptor lock.
Yes. And from a business perspective, because you cannot patent an old, widely available generic drug like racemic ketamine, pharmaceutical companies isolated the S form, developed it into a proprietary nasal spray delivery system, and patented it.
Ah, capitalism at work.
Indeed. They marketed it under the brand name Spravato. In 2019, the FDA officially approved Spravato for treatment-resistant depression. But at the time, it came with a major limiting caveat. It was only approved to be used alongside a traditional daily oral antidepressant.
So in 2019, it was just an add-on therapy. You couldn't use it on its own.
Correct.
But our source text, published today, highlights a massive landscape-altering update to this story. In January 2025, just over a year ago, the FDA made a groundbreaking decision based on the results of a massive Phase 4 clinical trial.
Yeah, the data generated by that Phase 4 trial was simply too overwhelming for the regulatory bodies to ignore. It shifted the standard of care.
The numbers in the article are wild. Researchers tested the esketamine nasal spray as a standalone treatment against a placebo. At the four-week mark, 22.5% of the severe treatment-resistant patients on esketamine had reached full clinical remission.
Let me repeat that word, because in psychiatry, it's huge. Remission.
Remission.
Not just feeling a little bit better, not just a reduction in symptoms, but no longer meeting the clinical criteria for depression at all.
Compare that to just 7.6% of the patients on the placebo who achieved remission. Based on that undeniable efficacy, the FDA approved Spravato as the first ever standalone or monotherapy treatment for treatment-resistant depression.
Which was a huge deal.
You don't need to take the daily oral SSRI pill anymore if your doctor prescribes it this way.
That approval was a massive historic validation of the entire glutamatergic model of depression we've been discussing. However, this is precisely where we have an obligation to ground the conversation.
Yeah, we have to talk about the downsides.
We have to look at the honest risks, the side effects, and the very real dark side of this molecule. Because, as you noted earlier, manipulating the brain's fundamental wiring is not without severe consequence if done improperly.
Right. The OOTW Journal article devotes a significant portion to detailing the dangers, pushing back against the idea that this is a flawless miracle cure. Let's start with the acute risks that happen during the treatment itself. Why do patients have to be monitored so closely?
Well, when you administer ketamine or esketamine, it reliably causes a significant, sometimes dramatic spike in both blood pressure and heart rate.
Oh, wow.
For a young, healthy person, this might be manageable, but for a patient with underlying cardiovascular issues or hypertension, that spike is a serious medical concern that requires immediate monitoring.
That makes sense.
Additionally, it causes heavy sedation, dizziness, and of course the profound dissociation we explored earlier. A patient is physically and cognitively impaired during the peak of the drug's effect. They cannot safely drive a car, operate machinery, or go about their normal day immediately after taking a dose.
Which is exactly why you can't just pick up an esketamine inhaler at the local pharmacy and use it on your couch while watching TV.
No, absolutely not. The FDA recognized this danger, which is why esketamine is dispensed exclusively under highly restricted, strict monitoring programs.
So they have to go in.
Right. A patient must go to a certified medical clinic, administer the dose under direct observation, and then they are medically quarantined and observed for a minimum of 2 hours before they are evaluated and released to a driver.
But the risks of ketamine go far beyond just the 2 hours of elevated heart rate in the clinic. The source text details some truly frightening, permanent long-term dangers, particularly for people who bypass the medical system and use ketamine recreationally without supervision.
Yeah, this is severe.
We need to talk about what it does to the bladder.
This is perhaps the most distinctive, unexpected, and physically devastating harm associated with ketamine abuse. It's a condition called ketamine-induced cystitis.
Cystitis.
It was first thoroughly documented in chronic, heavy, recreational users, often young people taking large amounts of the powder frequently on the club scene, completely unaware of the physical toll it was taking on their organs.
What exactly is happening biologically? Why does a drug that targets brain receptors destroy the bladder?
It comes back to the metabolites we discussed earlier.
Like HNK.
Similar. When the liver breaks down ketamine, it produces several byproducts, including norketamine. These metabolites are eventually filtered out of the blood by the kidneys and collect in the urine, sitting in the bladder before being expelled.
Okay, so they're just hanging out in there.
The problem is that these specific ketamine metabolites are highly, profoundly toxic to the urothelium, the delicate mucosal lining of the urinary tract and bladder.
So the toxic byproducts are just sitting there burning the tissue.
They trigger a massive inflammatory response. They penetrate the mucosal layer and cause apoptosis, which is cellular death.
Oh my God.
Over time, with frequent heavy use, this constant microscopic damage causes the flexible tissue of the bladder to undergo fibrosis. It literally replaces healthy, expansive tissue with rigid, thick scar tissue.
So it loses its stretch.
Exactly. Mm. The bladder shrinks in capacity and becomes ulcerated. It is intensely, chronically painful. It leads to constant, urgent urination, sometimes dozens of times a day. And in severe cases, the scarring is entirely irreversible.
That is horrifying.
Some young recreational users have required major reconstructive surgery or even complete surgical removal of the bladder just to survive the pain.
That is. Wow. And it underscores the profound danger of unmonitored frequent use. It's not just a psychological risk of having a bad trip. It is a brutal, corrosive physical toxicity if abused at high doses.
And that leads right into the other major glaring concern, psychological dependence.
Addiction.
Ketamine is a Schedule III controlled substance for a very good reason. While it does not cause the severe physical withdrawal symptoms associated with opioids or alcohol, the subjective feeling of dissociation, that total floating escape from the heavy burden of reality, can be highly habit-forming.
I can easily see how that would happen.
For someone trying to self-medicate deep emotional pain or trauma, the desire to return to that disconnected void can become an overwhelming psychological addiction.
So we have this incredible life-saving medical tool that can regrow brain synapses, but it is inextricably tethered to a drug with severe abuse potential and toxic physical side effects, which brings up the tragic catch of the whole treatment protocol, the challenge of maintenance.
Yeah, the maintenance is tough.
We mentioned way back at the beginning that the clinical effect of a single dose fades in a few days or a week. You don't just take it once, regrow the twigs, and walk away cured forever.
That is the hardest, most frustrating clinical reality of ketamine therapy. The rapid structural rebuild of the synapses by the mTOR pathway is phenomenal to witness, but it is not a permanent, indestructible fix.
The stress can still prune it back.
Exactly. Mm. If the underlying root causes of the depression, whether that is ongoing environmental stress, unresolved trauma, or deep genetic predispositions, remain active, the brain remains under assault. The newly grown dendritic spines can, and often do, degrade and wither away again. The cortisol pruning returns.
So, to maintain the structural integrity of the network, the treatment requires repeated, carefully spaced sessions. A patient might go into the clinic twice a week initially to build foundation, then step down to once a week, then maybe once a month for long-term maintenance.
Yes, it requires an ongoing commitment. The therapeutic model relies entirely on maintaining that strict clinical structure and cadence.
So you really need the doctor.
And this is a crucial point to emphasize as we look at the landscape. The gap between supervised clinical care and unsupervised recreational use is a massive, dangerous chasm. The clinical environment strictly controls the dose to maximize MTOR activation while minimizing toxicity.
Right.
They control the frequency to prevent tolerance and dependence, and they monitor the cardiovascular side effects. Unsupervised use-taking, unknown, often massive doses with unknown frequency, to chase the dissociative high is, as the OATW article starkly states, where most of the harm lives.
It's a delicate tightrope walk. We are harnessing a powerful, volatile, potentially toxic molecule to perform microscopic, targeted neurosurgery on the brain's wiring.
That is a very apt description. It demands a profound respect for the chemistry involved.
Okay, let's take a deep breath and look back at the massive amount of ground we've covered today. We started our journey with a drug synthesized in 1962, originally designed just to be a safer, calmer, battlefield anesthetic than PCP.
What a journey it's been.
We followed a molecule that spent a half century bouncing between the sterile lights of pediatric operating rooms and the flashing strobes of underground raves. And then, through a series of rebellious, paradigm-shifting medical trials in the mid-2000s, it forced the entire field of psychiatry to abandon the long-held dogma that depression is merely a slow-moving serotonin imbalance.
It proved, with undeniable clinical and biological evidence, that severe depression is a physical, structural loss of synaptic connections, driven by the toxicity of chronic stress.
And far more importantly than just identifying the damage, it proved that those lost, withered connections can be rapidly regrown.
That's the miracle of it.
By introducing a molecule that acts like a highly specific microscopic wedge, selectively blocking the NMDA receptors on the brain's regulatory GABA brakes, we trigger a massive, disinhibited glutamate surge. We unleash the brain's own cellular 3D printer, the MTOR pathway, to physically rebuild the dendritic spines in a matter of hours, restoring the network's capacity for complex thought and emotional resilience.
It is the story of discovering how to cut the chemical brakes to jumpstart structural repair.
So what does this all mean? Why does this deep dive matter to you, listening to this right now? Well, whether you personally struggle with clinical depression or whether you've never experienced a depressive episode in your life, understanding the mechanics of ketamine gives you a profound, awe-inspiring look at the brain's breathtaking neuroplasticity.
It really does.
Your brain is not a static, unchanging block of tissue that you are stuck with. It is a living, breathing, dynamic network. Yes, it has the tragic capacity to break down, to wither, and to prune its own connections under the crushing weight of chronic stress and trauma. But it also possesses this incredible, inherent, almost magical power to rapidly rebuild itself when given the right molecular key.
The physical architecture of your mind is constantly under construction.
Exactly.
If we connect everything we've learned today to the bigger picture of human biology, it raises a truly profound question, something for you to think about and explore long after this deep dive ends.
What's that?
Well, the source text revealed that the human brain can physically regrow the complex connections lost to severe chronic stress in just a matter of hours, simply by removing the inhibitory brakes on a specific receptor. It makes you wonder if this spectacular latent capacity for rapid structural repair already exists for depression. What other innate rapid healing mechanisms might be lying dormant right now in our neurobiology, just waiting for science to find the right molecular switch to turn them on?
Oh, man, that is a fascinating, hopeful thought to end on. If we can learn to fix a broken mind as fast as we can set a broken bone, the future of medicine is going to be truly wild. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious.